altimetry sensitivity driven by their nervous system. And even though we can create an environment for us larger, even so as primates, which were tested from the 60s to be up there, birds, I just cannot deal with the change in the altitude.
Okay, that's an interesting suggestion, George. In this case, it's not the overwhelming problem. I'll give everyone a little hint. Most animals that have gone into space tend to be either four-footed, or they evolved from being four-footed. Whereas kind of birds right past its dinosaur beginnings, they were kind of two-legged animals. That imposes a slightly different route that their evolution took, which undermines their ability to deal with zero gravity. So maybe that's a hint. Anyone want to kind of think that one through?
And one whitey white.
Yes, thanks.
Two things. First is they don't have hands. They can't really use their wings to slow them down should they bounce from one surface to another in the spacecraft. And the second thing is that some birds have the ability to sense magnetic direction due to a property in their brain. I'm wondering if they would get confused not being or being above the magnetic field of the Earth.
Okay, I think both of those would impact on the bird. Matter of fact, there is a article in this week's link which discusses how scientists are beginning to think that animals are able to sense their local magnetic fields. And apparently it may be due to an actually quantum mechanical effect on a particular protein. So it would certainly disorient the bird. It would decrease its mobility. But none of these things, I think, would basically kill the bird. What I'm looking here for is something that's definitely, absolutely, positively going to kill the darn bird.
Little pockets of no oxygen.
Well, no, I don't think there's pockets of no oxygen in a spacecraft. I mean, I hope not. That would be problematic. K2STP in the chat room, I think, was mentioning a lack of gravity. Well, yeah, it's due to a lack of gravity, but the question is basically, why would a canary kill by a lack of gravity? And that's ultimately what I'm trying to get at here.
TXF.
Yes, Rich.
They cannot stay upright on a perch because they don't know what upright is.
Okay, that's possible. Again, I would be incredibly curious of what would happen if you actually got a bird in zero gravity before you killed the poor thing. But, you know, again, for public relations reasons, I guess NASA doesn't want to really do that experiment. You know, worst comes to worst, it could sort of sit, hover, stand, well, either sit or stand. It could just probably hover in the cage, bouncing off of it, a very unhappy animal. I mean, it might get depressed and want to commit suicide, but thankfully, that's kind of difficult for a bird. So that would be its cause of death. Something else very serious would be its cause of death.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
It sounds like it has to be biological. Either for some reason they can't breathe, I'm not sure about the mechanism for breathing on a bird, or maybe they can't eat, or maybe they can't even drink water, maybe they can't swallow. Something along those lines. Back to you, Rick.
Bingo. Bingo. Like I mentioned before, most animals that are brought up to space evolved from at least at one point a four-footed animal where their Where their stomach sometimes was not that terribly lower than their mouth and the other bits and pieces of their esophagus. So they've all evolved smooth muscles that constantly are pushing stuff from the very top of the alimentary canal, the throat, and the esophagus all the way to the end of the alimentary canal in the rectum. So we all have that going on. We can sometimes hear the sound of gas and other things moving through our intestines, which is army term for pterygomy. Birds do not have that for the most part. Many birds, including the canaries, do not have any muscle in their tube connecting to their stomach sac, and so they rely purely and completely on gravity. They take a drink, they raise their heads and bend them slightly back and clear the path in their going down to the stomach. So if you took a canary into space, into very low gravity or zero gravity, very soon they would die of dehydration because they would be unable to actually get any water down their gullet. So that's the reason why birds are not very good in zero gravity. You're not going to be seeing too many birds going into space unless or until we figure out some means of producing artificial gravity, either centrifugal or through technology yet to be dreamed of. Yeah, Chris in the chat room says he wonders how many other animals would have the same problem. A lot of birds do. Again, mostly animals that are four-legged tend to evolve some kind of mechanism that doesn't require gravity. So my guess would be reptiles and mammals and a lot of other types of animals that aren't birds wouldn't have that much of a problem eating and drinking. But birds, you would somehow have to manually feed them, which would be a real pain in the backside for the astronaut. Okay, well, that's my three puzzles for tonight. I hope you found them amusing and interesting. Does anyone else have any questions or topics tonight? They can be the technical aspects of amateur radio, they can be general science, or they can be medical, as long as they're not personal, not specific. Any scientific questions or topics or comments, please hit that push to talk button, give me your first name and call sign.
W2BZ?
Yes, Rich.
I wonder if there's anybody out there familiar with bulbs that change color.
Okay, I'm assuming that you mean light-emitting diodes that have more than one constant color and that are hooked in through usually things like Bluetooth or some other 2.4 gigahertz RF signal to adjust the intensity of its red, green, and blue LEDs built in. Is that what you're alluding to?
Well, I can't believe you know it was 2.4 and not 5 gigahertz. Yes, that's exactly what I was asking about. Those 2.4 bulbs that filaments go through the spectrum and change color.
Okay, I mean, it's 2.4 because the 2.4 chips are a little bit cheaper than the 5 gigahertz chips. And I have a few of them, and they refuse to operate at anything but 2.4. But is there any particular question? Philips is probably the initial inventor and promoter of this technology. They've gone through a couple of generations. My nephew has them in his bedroom. When he first got them, he had this uncontrollable desire to color code events. So he watched something, for some reason he picked red lights, and other things warranted blue lights, and he kind of got out of the habit, I think. But since then, a lot of other companies have gone into that field. The prices have thankfully gone lower, and the range has gone a little bit better. The original Philips colored controls of LED bulbs had problems with certain colors for some odd reason. Of course, the way that color LEDs usually work is that the emitters are UV LEDs, and then you put fluorescent dyes on them, and so they phosphoresce at different colors, some being red, some being green, some being blue. But what particular aspects are you curious about?
I was just trying to set them up. I can get it to the point where, now I don't know if this is trying to pair or they are pairing, is when they flash. They go from a bright, bright bluish-white color down to a very, very warm yellowish color and pulsate. That's as far as I can go. I can't get them to do anything else than that pulsating. And after, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, the light turns off. So I just can't figure out what I'm doing that makes me unable to control the bulb after that pulsating phase. Go ahead.
Okay. What's the manufacturer of this product?
Well, there are two. There's the bulb itself, which is Lumaman, which gotten, you know, pretty good reviews. And the smart plug is by TP-Link. Or does it say compatible with? Just 1 second. No. The smart plug is TP-Link. Go ahead.
The Lumaman, I guess, is the LED with the three colored elements inside them. But they require, I guess, some force. These electronic variable color bulbs come in different complications, if you will. The simplest ones, like I guess you have, require a separate control that links with the Wi-Fi and an app that you use and then talks to the bulb. Some of the slightly more sophisticated bulbs directly link to your local Wi-Fi access point, and you control them with a separate app on your cell phone that also links to that Wi-Fi link. So I'm trying to figure out exactly where it sounds like it's failing something. It might be linking to the TP-Link, but the TP-Link might not be linking to your Wi-Fi access point. If you have an IP sniffer, you might want to kind of check to see if these guys are anywhere to be found. Maybe they need a DHCP address. Maybe they land on a weird address that you have to do something to correct. There's a whole bunch of different possibilities for this one.
Roy, somebody else doubled with you. So, Mr. Doubler, could you go ahead and say what you were saying?
Hey, Roy, this is WS2N. I heard Frank, B2BXO, coming in there. I think he's got problems with Echo Link. He's asking about it, whether or not it's on our end or his end.
Okay. Frank, if you're hearing me out there, which you should, I have my Echo Link open. You're there. There's another gentleman, Michael, and I'm there. So it seems to be fine on our end. You were having problems disconnecting your transmission earlier. The mic was live for about a minute or so before you killed the connection. But I think our Echo Link is working the way it's supposed to. Might be something a little wonky on your end.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to check. I apologize for the disruption. I realized, even though it didn't show the mic was live before, that the mic might be live, so I just swiped out the app. I realized it. Anyway, back to next, the B2BX, so thanks.
Okay, Frank. So going back to you, Rich. Have you tried an IP sniffer to see if anything is connected? At the very least, I would assume your TP link should be connected to your Wi-Fi access point.
No, both of the bolts definitely do show up. And they give you a connected no internet, which is, I would think, normal for something like this. But I don't think it would have anything to do with ports, Roy, because, you know, these are for the consumer, and most consumers don't really know what a port is, except like the port of New Jersey. So I just can't figure out, and it can't be both of the bolts that are bad, and I have four plugs, so, and I switched them around, so it can't be everything's, you know, bad out of six different devices. So I just can't figure it out. It should go beyond that pairing stage, and then I'm supposed to, I guess, be able to, if that's how it works in the first place, I guess I'm supposed to be able to control the color once it's paired, but that's not happening.
Well, is there an Android app? I mean, these things usually have some control device that ends up being just an application that's either for Android and iOS, and that it has to be, sometimes it has to be connected to the same Wi-Fi. Sometimes, thankfully, it just needs hooked up to the same network, and that's the controller. So my guess is there's some linkage thing that's supposed to go on that's not. The point of failure might be your Wi-Fi access point, because that's the commonality. Even though you have two bulbs and four plugs, you have one Wi-Fi access. So the TP-Link trying to make a link to your Wi-Fi might be having some kind of failure mode.
So maybe if I should try to reboot the router?
Yeah, at the very least, I would try and do that. If you can get into the router and you can get an idea, because there's usually a screen with the IP address of devices that log into it that access it. So it'll give you certainly a better degree of knowledge. If you find that there's no entry for your TP-Link, then it's not doing the proper link to the Wi-Fi access point. And, you know, even if you were able to link the bulb to the TP-Link, if they're not going to link to the Wi-Fi access point, there's no way that you can actually control them.
So ready to turn my shack into what looked like a house of ill repute, and I guess that's not what the higher power intended ham radio to look like. So that's what I'll do. I will reboot this router and see if anything happens. But usually, my experience tells me it's not that. The other thing, and God forbid, I'll have to do this tomorrow, is call tech support. And we ham radio operators hate, at least this one does, hate calling tech support. So, but nothing else works. That's what I'll be doing.
Hey, well, I wish you luck, Rich, with this and with all things. You, unfortunately, and I don't want to rain on your parade, you got an even slightly bigger problem. If this was, say, a Philips bulb, and so you called up Philips and you asked them, you might actually get someone who knows what they're talking about. My guess is this is a Chinese import. The guys who know anything about it don't speak English, and the guys who speak English probably don't know anything about it. So probably you're going to end up sending it back to Amazon, who generally is very nice about that. But I hope they're able to answer your question. Hopefully it'll be a simple one.
Okay, thanks, Roy. Yeah, it should be a simple one if it's these, like I said before, if these are really produced for the general public. I could imagine, you know, somebody who knows something about electronics and networks and stuff like that can't get it working. There's got to be millions of people who can't get it working. And that would put a company under real quick. So I'll report back. I've been trying this for a good hour with both all these combinations, and it's just not working. But I'll get there. I always do. It wastes a life trying to figure this stuff out, but who needs a life anyway? We don't, not ham radio operators. So back to you, Roy, W2BZ.
AC2GX. Well, look at it as a challenge. People love challenges. So this, consider this just another computer-related challenge. I have way too many computer-related challenges. I would like a less challenging computer. Occasionally, you kind of get what you're hoping for. I had a piece of software that I had bought a couple years ago that didn't play well with another piece of software. And it was a mom-and-pop type of a job. So I emailed the guy who writes it, and he kind of gave me a vague comment and kind of waved me off. But I went back on the email, and I explained explicitly what the software was. I gave him a link page to it, and I guess on the second attempt, he understood what I was trying to get at. And a couple of days later, he says, here's a link to a fix, and it fixed. It worked. So you know, sometimes guys are very good about that. If you're able to explain it to them and kind of throw a little cold water in their face to wake them up a little bit, they'll go that extra mile. So, again, I hope they go that extra mile with you. My guess is if you end up talking to someone in Amazon, they'll just offer to take it back and refund your money. But we'll see.
We shall see. I'll tell you next week if I have a red ham shack.
Okay, I look forward to the report, Rick. So, Frank, WB2BXO, would you like to discuss your mailbag question of a couple of weeks ago? I mean, it's always good to kind of talk about these things. They're fundamental concepts in electronics. I'm sorry, Frank. Your transmission broke up. I just heard one or two syllables.
Yeah, I was not certain if you were asking me if we should go ahead with my question. If not, just go ahead with whatever whoever you were going to speak with. Go ahead.
Yeah, Frank, I thought we would discuss your question. It was a few weeks ago. I mean, the basic question, again, as far as I can recall, was that you had a 3,600 milliamp hour battery that was charged. You had a 1,800 milliamp hour battery that was discharged. And you were hoping to be able to use the bigger battery to charge the smaller battery twice because of the rated capacity of these rechargeable radio batteries, rather. But unfortunately, the law of thermodynamics will tell us all that you're never going to get a 100 efficient transfer of energy or conversion of energy. Just by that alone, you're not going to get that much power into the smaller battery. But there are other complications with electrochemical batteries. Electrochemical batteries are rated in their amp hours, which is another way of describing coulombs of charge, the number of electrons that are packed up and ready to go on a battery, based upon a given current. As you generate the battery through a lower and lower current, you usually are able to extract more energy out of it. If you try to extract all of the energy very quickly, because of the internal resistance of the battery, a lot of it is dissipated in heat and not transferred. In addition, as you increase in the battery, the chemistry of the reaction, it becomes less efficient, so you lose energy that way. So the problem is that the rated power, how many milliamp hours a given rechargeable battery has, is based upon a nebulous concept of what the current draw is. If you're recharging the battery, you tend to not do it very, very slowly, because people want their battery charged quickly. So that's the reason for dissipation of energy. The law of conservation, thermodynamics, is a limitation. And the chemistry of a battery's reaction, oxidation reduction, is a limitation. So all those things limit your ability to transfer the power, and a lot of it is relay heat. Charge that small battery twice, or anything close to it. So that's kind of what we were talking about last time. Any questions, Frank, or comments?
Yes, so the short answer is that charging a cell phone battery from one of these juice packs is nowhere near 100% efficient. Which is something I realized, I think, after I emailed you the question, is, hey, things, nothing in electronics is 100% efficient. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fundamental concept to walk away with. There are complications in that there are other things that drive down the efficiency of transfer of power, because batteries are not idealized devices. Their oxidation reduction electrochemical reaction, rather than having the electron transfer happening in solution like a lot of chemical reactions tend to, we are forcing the electrons to go through a outside conductor in order to balance the charges and such. But yeah, that's the bottom line. But it's a sort of fascinating thing. I mean, we do it all the time. I mean, companies, all these Chinese companies sell lithium iron batteries that can be charged and then used to charge other USB devices. But, you know, every time you do that, there's a loss of efficiency, there's a loss of power. It's much better to directly charge things up than to charge them up through intermediates or even through wireless connections to have introduced their own inefficiencies as well. But it's convenient, and don't mind paying more for their electric bill, apparently. So people, it's a lot less efficient means to get electricity to their device.
That's a very good point that I actually didn't think of. It is actually an inefficient means to charge. The cell phone charger, what's sometimes called a juice pack from the main, and then use the juice pack charge the cell phone, which is exactly what I'm doing now, but just sitting outside on my balcony with a cell phone and a juice, or iPhone and a juice pack, recharging the phone. I have a vaccine question. Would you like to address that or do that another time? Go ahead.
No, sure. We're in the all science area of the technical net. I just want to throw out if Blue NY2H is out there. I don't think our IRLP node is active tonight. I'm looking at the IRLP website, and Barrie, Ontario, in Canada, is on our node. I think they've automated the process. It begins at around 8:30 and ends at 11. But there's no indication that our own IRLP node is connected to this. So Ontario might be just listening to themselves on the IRLP. So if Lou's out there, if you could just take a look and come back later on, I'd appreciate it. Okay, Frank, what's your question for tonight?
You don't have a DMR connection to the TechNet, do you?
No, we don't. I don't know if that's really something that you could sort of legitimately do. I mean, non-legitimately, you could feed anything into a talk group and then send the talk group out through Gateway. But we're an analog system, so there's nothing on the repeater that does any kind of digital mode. We do IRLP, we do Echolink, but that's about all of it.
Uh, You're probably right. They probably don't want an, may not want an analog repeater coming into the gateway. It's probably technically feasible, though. Well, there's a bunch of problems with the way DMR works. I guess we can have another session on everything that's wrong with DMR some other night. Anyway, my vaccine question was with regard to the J&J vaccine, which I understand differently than the other vaccines. Is that how, with regard to the variant, how good is, what is your understanding of how good the J&J vaccine is at protecting from the variants as compared to the other vaccines? I don't know if there's a short answer to that one. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, the J&J vaccine works on a with a different method. The other two that we know and love are messenger RNA vaccines. In other words, they coded the protein codon that's in the actual virus's RNA into messenger RNA. That are used in the transcription in cells to turn a messenger RNA into an actual protein for the spikes that you see in all the images of coronavirus. Without the spikes, it isn't able to trick cells into taking it into the cellular fluid and thereby allowing it to destroy the cell and spread itself. So those use messenger RNA, which looks like they might be an incredibly useful technology for not only other vaccinations, but in some form of immunotherapy for some forms of cancer. J&J uses a different principle. They take a pacified adenovirus that can infect human beings, but cause next to no symptoms or problems. And they have included the DNA, well, the RNA, for the same spike protein in the adenovirus. So it's a case, whereas the messenger RNA are simply fat globules with messenger RNA inside them that gets sucked up into the cells and the protein produce antibodies to it. All these studies about the variant and how well the different vaccines work against the variant is very, very, you know, early on. There's going to be a lot more work done. They find that there's an appreciable benefit to taking two vaccines of the messenger RNA type, the Moderna and the other one. One shot will give you approximately, they say, 33% immunity to the variant, whereas two shots will bring it up to the 90s. I haven't seen nice firm results as far as Johnson & Johnson, so that's yet to be determined, although there'll be a degree of crossover. The question is what the percentage will be. But, you know, I keep looking, but I haven't found anything myself.
Okay, so the answer is the reason we haven't heard much about J&J vaccine and the variant is that the medical community just does not have an answer yet. All right, thanks a lot, Roy. Back to that. You'll be 2BX now.
AC2GX. Well, yeah, in addition to that, you have to also understand that there's only so many research out there, and the overwhelming majority of the American public have taken the Moderna and the other messenger RNA. Johnson & Johnson dropped all kinds of balls. The factory that was manufacturing it became contaminated. A lot of samples, a lot of vaccines had to be gotten rid of with the Johnson & Johnson. So I again, don't quite remember what the percentage is, but the overwhelming percentage of people got their vaccinations, got the messenger RNA. But, yeah, all this will come out eventually. It's still the ball's still in motion. We've only gotten 40% of our population fully vaccinated. 60% to one degree or another are either partially vaccinated or previously infected or not at all. So that's a big reservoir. When the Delta variant kind of becomes the overwhelming majority, it's going to be more opportunity for that variant to mutate into yet some other variant that may or may not have more problems with the vaccine being covered for it. This book still has not been fully written, and people are going to be looking at it closely as time goes on. They're already designing variant boosters. Probably they're going to have to go back to the lab and concoct other ones, because before this is all over, I assume there's going to be more variants out there. There's just too many people running around with these viral particles mutating along. Oh, by the way, Lou mentioned on the Echo link that the IRLP audio connections from the sound card are flaky and scheduled to be restarted soon. So, thankfully, Echo link was down for a few days. It's now back up and working. So IRLP is now needed some tender loving care. So I thank Lou and the rest of the technical staff for maintaining all this equipment so that we could lather on it.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
To stick with the vaccine topic a second, suppose somebody took the Johnson & Johnson and they thought to themselves, maybe I should have gotten a Pfizer, you know, and they bypassed the system somehow. What would happen if they got a shot? I mean, would they, you know, be very sick? Would they be healthier than ever because now they have an extra shot? You know, what would be the end result of something like that? I know there's got to be a character out there that's done this. Back to you.
Yeah, probably more than a few. Well, on the negative side, as a lot of people who took their second booster shot of either the Pfizer or the Moderna, it kind of knocks you out for a day. You get kind of a brain fog, some people call it. Other people describe it as feeling like they're coming down with something, but rather than it getting worse, it just fades away. So you put yourself at a little bit more risk of the side effects of boosting your system. You slightly increase the risk of kind of triggering inflammatory processes of an overworked immune system. The benefit, though, is you probably end up with even better immunity to the virus and probably to a degree the variants than you had before. So, you know, I wouldn't at all be surprised if somewhere down the road someone suggests a single booster from either of the messenger RNA variety as the next line of treatment. So it entails a very small risk. It is with slightly better results, if you will. I don't think anyone in the medical field is going to suggest people do that yet until or unless there's really significant research that demonstrates a significant benefit, just in case, you know, they cause more problems than they solve.
That's interesting. Very good. I wonder if the booster, they just did decide, if they decide to give people boosters, is it going to be the same identical shot as what they got before? Let's say you got a Johnson & Johnson, you get the exact same dose, and same for Moderna and Pfizer.
Well, again, none of this is written in stone. My surmise would be that the booster would include messenger RNA coded to the modified spike protein variants like variant Delta. That's another good reason to introduce another one rather than just kick someone's immunity from, say, I don't know, 70% back to 95%. This will also give people a better protection against the variants, and to a lesser extent, the variants that will come out of the Delta variant. Because, like I said, it's running rampant over over large areas, and India especially, but in Great Britain it's taking over. In the United States, I think it's rated at around 40% of all infections. That's going to probably go up. So there'll be a variant based on the D variant, the Delta variant, that the booster shot will include, most likely, messenger RNA coded specifically against this particular variant spike protein.
Wow, that would be a big change. You know, the companies would then have to retool and completely make new vaccines, you know? I mean, it's the same system, but it would have to be different. Million doses would have to go out to the United States, you know, assuming you're going to get 300 million people to take it, which I don't think you'll get that many, but, you know, I could see them making that many more, except a completely different recipe. That would be a big deal. Wow. Okay. I thought maybe they would just, you know, take what you have and just mass produce it. Everybody would get the same thing. But you're saying no. They're going to take into consideration the variants.
Yes, but worry not. Using the same messenger RNA technology that brought the vaccine so quickly to use is being used once again for the variants. The companies that made the original vaccine have already begun work on the variant booster. They might use it. They might have to upgrade it to something else by the time that it's warranted, but the only thing that's problematic is the production. But by the time that they need the a booster shot, they'll probably have more than enough production facilities to crank it out. And you're quite right. I seriously doubt that a overwhelming majority of Americans will go for the booster because they didn't go for the original vaccine either. So whereas maybe when this is all over, 50% of the population is vaccinated, I would think that the booster will probably only get to about 40%. But like I said, they're working on it to this day. They could probably pump it out in production. They're also, I think, doing phase one and phase two studies with it to just make sure that it's still as safe as it ever was.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Roy.
Okay, once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm a control operator for ZIS, the Linemark Technical Net. We're here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. And we try and discuss the latest, greatest technology. Amateur radio has a lot of great technology. Frank mentioned with VR. Some people love it. Some people hate it. Digital modes, FT8, slow scan, television, microwaves, low frequencies, all manner of things available to be discussed. And if that's not enough for you, we'll try and talk about any kind of field of science as best as we can, or medicine, as long as it's not personal problems. You know, we don't treat people and diagnose people over the radio. But that's the purpose for this technical net. So, again, if anyone has any questions or comments or would like to express something, science, technology, what have you, hit that push the talk button, give us your first name and call sign.
Yes, W-A-T-Z-D-H. I have a really related question.
Okay, John.
I guess going back about 30 years ago, I got one of these commercial RIDI decoders made by Universal Shortwave. It decodes all kinds of strange modes of commercial radio teletype, ARC-E, ARC-4, SITOR, which is like an amateur AMTOR, and a bunch of other strange modes. And I used to hear a lot of commercial RIDI stations on the general HF band. And I just wondered whatever happened to all of this. I used to be able to copy in the Marine band. I used to hear WLO in Mobile, Alabama, communicating with a lot of vessels at sea. And I used to hear a lot of SITOR, which is the the AMTOR mode A. And I don't hear any of that anymore. I just wonder what happened to it, if you know any details about it. Go ahead.
Okay, I personally don't, because that's kind of esoteric to me. I would assume they either went through the final technological phase of something like AMTOR, which is an expensive box. You can buy an AMTOR encoder decoder. They are still under patent, I think, and so there's a relatively hefty fee for it. I think a lot of these organizations simply shifted to other modes, possibly modes that could be encrypted. I don't know whether that pre-packet technology can be encrypted. I would imagine it could, but RITI really does lend itself. RITI is still alive and well on the amateur bands. There's still a RITI contest. There are software that you can actually run for a wide band if you have the ability to pump out a IQ audio signal of say 92 kilohertz or 180 kilohertz. You can feed it into and get a whole bunch of RITI station transmissions. So, you know, RITI's still around. It's not as quite as glamorous as the newer technologies because there's no real error correction. There's no redundancy. So if it fades out, your signal fades out with it. It's a lot more sensitive to phase than even phase shift speed PSK was, and now especially FT8 is.
Yeah, well, one thing I've noticed about the only commercial RITI, I'm not talking so much amateur now, I'm looking more at the commercial in the regular HF band. The only thing I can copy regularly now is something called NavTex. It goes out at 518 kilohertz, and it's basically AMTOR mode B, the synchronous transmission. And it's designed to give navigation warnings and information for mariners, you know, on the high seas. It, as I say, it's basically a mode B AMTOR, which is a synchronous. But there used to be a lot of other stuff. There used to be these voice frequency telegraphy signals. I don't know if you remember those signals on HF that sounded like a buzzsaw. They were really basically a cluster of 12, sometimes 16, very narrow shift RITI signals all running together. And I used to be able to decode a couple of them. I would find usually an Associated Press feed in there. A lot of it was encrypted, but there was a lot of other stuff there, like the Associated Press and some of the news feeds. Just all seemed to have disappeared. I was just wondering if you knew anything about it then.
No, nothing specific. I think it's probably a combination of the usual reasons, the Internet, and just technology advancing. If you do have to do it through radio waves, you're probably better off using a technology that's more bulletproof, you know, with error correction and other things learned through Internet protocols and stuff. So, you know, it's sort of the same reason why there's very few national radio stations on shortwave, because a lot of them have decided that it's a lot cheaper to run a web server someplace rather than a 50 kilowatt, you know, shortwave station.
Yeah, that's a whole other discussion, too, what's happened to a lot of the commercial shortwave broadcasts. I know there used to be quite a few BBC channels, and now you don't hear very many of them all. I was just wondering, just a general topic of question answer. So I appreciate it. Thanks, Roy.
Okay, you're welcome. Anyone else with any comments, questions, topics, puzzles, what have you?
B2BX, I'm not sure if you heard the question I just posted to the Echo in chat. Go ahead.
Yeah, I saw it. Frank wonders if Paul can address the unidentified aerial phenomena report. He says, I have either of you guys read it for a good summary. Have either of you guys read it for a good summary? I've read a summary. For the life of me, I don't quite know what's going on with the armed forces. It's kind of like they're playing pokey-boo with people. The gist that I got was that they don't quite know what the cause for some of these things are. They have no proof that it's aliens, but they have no proof that it's not aliens. Whatever the hell that means. I don't know. I kind of don't trust them. Not that I think they're nefarious. If some of it is experimental weapons that the military is working on, I really don't expect them to fess up on it in a report. So I think that's kind of what's roaring it out. I don't think there's anything quite legitimate. But I think generated 9 pages. It's not that difficult. Matter of fact, I think on my link page I posted a source for you to out the 9-page report, read it completely. Again, I just had time to read the summary, which the response that I got from it is the armed forces can't prove anything, but they can't disprove much. So that was very useful. Paul, you have any comments on the recent report?
I'm just going to repeat pretty much what you just said. I did see Bill Nelson on tonight. Bill Nelson is now the new administrator for NASA. He was on CNN not too long before this net. And he was being interviewed about it, about that topic. And he's pretty much has said that we really don't know what it is. If it's foreign adversaries, that some kind of technology that we're not, that we don't know what it is, he would be concerned about it. He just doesn't think that it is that. He doesn't think they're that far ahead to do the kind of things that they're claiming has happened on all these videos and radars. He agrees there's billions of stars, billions of galaxies, but you can tell from the way he's talking, he kind of doesn't believe that it's some kind of extraterrestrial situation that's going on. Let's put it this way, he didn't rule it out, but you can tell from the way he's talking, I don't think he thinks that's even possible. I kind of go along with that. But he's up on all this stuff. He actually flew on the space shuttle when he was younger, when he was a congressman. But now he's the national administrator. He was just sworn in recently. Back to you, Ron.
Yeah. Okay. So I think a lot of people in the loop are a little embarrassed by having to deal with it, and I'm not quite sure exactly why they're dealing with it. I don't know the head Democratic senator or something like that. Was a real UFOologist, so he kind of started people on this this run, and for some odd reason the Air Force went along with it. So I don't know if they're trying to confuse or distract us. Well, what the heck is going on? But they seem to be asking particularly them. So I hope they kind of get it out of their system and be done with it. I've talked before what my personal attitude is. I think there's life in outer space. I think there's sentient life in outer space. I just think there's way too much space in outer space that any sentient culture would be motivated to waste a lot of time, effort, and resources to come by and say nano to us. So I think what we're looking at are optical illusions, confusion, and the odd experimental weapon that that government people we aren't anyone to know about at this point. So we'll see how things go. I don't know, Frank, did you read the 9-page report? Did you get anything different out of it than me and Paul?
You're probably thinking about Harry Reid, right?
Yeah, Harry Reid is a real ufologist. Every so often they'll go up to, I don't know, Arizona, New Mexico, some of those, one of those places, and interview him about the subject.
Okay, I'll let you go over. Go back to Frank.
GXR, recognize, I'm waiting for Frank, WB2BXO. I asked him a question, and there's a little bit of a delay because he's on echo rank.
Yeah, you know, I kind of put it aside. I didn't realize they did some, you know, it was a huge report with a short summary. Anyway, I feel like I'm a student who was caught without doing his homework. But no, I will look at it. Years ago, I wrote government book reports, not only read them, but I will try to read it before next week and try to read between the lines, so to speak, and see if I have a better take on it than everyone else has. I'm pretty sure I'm going to come up with the same point, the same view. Go ahead.
Yeah, I get the sense that this is the military kind of throwing chaff. You know, chaff is little bits of metal that confuse radar signals so that you can escape the enemy. So I think this is just an execution of jettisoning some public relations chaff for some reason. They're trying to distract us from something entirely different. But read through it at your leisure, and if you want to tell us your opinion next Sunday, I would be very interested to hear it.
Good evening, NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
Yeah, hi. I'm fading in and out of consciousness because of staying up for the entire field day, and we worked a lot of stations. It's my understanding that Senator Marco Rubio had this added to a piece of legislation that was passed, so that the military was mandated to do this. I don't think they wanted to do it on their own.
Yeah, I agree with you. That was my understanding as well for this report. But it's not only this report. The Air Force released a lot of this video a couple of years ago and just kind of said, well, we don't want to really talk about it, but people have been talking about it, so here's the video. Have fun. So I wouldn't direct all of my confusion to Marco Rubio, although he has been a source of much of my confusion through the years. But yeah, this present report is not the military's, caused by the military. It's caused by those wonderful people in the Senate that we pay to do this stuff with. But they were doing weird things by releasing videos of inconclusive findings years ago. So they're in on it too for some strange reason, I think.
Yeah, it's also my understanding that those videos were leaked originally, and you're correct, the military then, owned up to them. But again, I don't think the release was specifically initiated by them.
Well, I don't know what's going on out there. It doesn't do our government well that there's a lot of things to spend your energy with. This is about the last one, and I can't begin to tell you how sad it made me to watch the episode of 60 Minutes for this stuff. It has soiled itself. It is no longer, in my humble opinion, what it once was. It's little more than the Inquirer these days, apparently.
Well, I suppose if you subtract the commercials out, it's not really 60 Minutes anyway. All right. Very good. And Y2H.
Okay, we had someone who, I didn't get his full call sign. I just got his suffix, DSR. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, it's Bob here, N2GXR. I was an eyewitness to some object, strange object in 2010, so I'm an eyewitness.
Okay, I mean, there are a lot of people who are eyewitnesses to a lot of things. The problem is that, you know, these are terms that I think they don't like to use on a